more people died after Hurricane Laura from carbon monoxide poisoning from running their gas generators in their garage than from the hurricane surge itself. We're playing whack-a-mole with disasters these days, and we're not using the right tools. Internal combustion engine is still the only tool in most responders' toolkits, and that's insane in 2024. Oftentimes, there's such a white horse mentality in aid where it's like, we have this thing, we fundraised for it, we're going to get in our truck and go down and like do the thing, take a bunch of photos and put them on Instagram, and then leave. I'm really excited to see more critical thinking in how, why, and who is responding. The tech doesn't really matter if you don't have the right people using it.
Welcome to the Blue Economy Primer, a New Orleans-based podcast where you learn from the experts the practical tools and solution sets that will empower your community to adapt and thrive in a new blue era of rising seas and economic discontinuity.
Today, we're speaking with a clean energy pioneer and leader in the extremely carbon-intensive disaster response sector. Will's organization, Footprint Project, has gained national recognition for its grassroots work helping communities not only restore critical power supplies with renewable energy generator sets, but providing the training and know-how to transform normally marginalized groups and communities into resilient, well-prepared, clean energy pioneers. Will, thank you so much for joining us in the Blue Economy Primer. Can you please introduce yourself to our audience?
Thanks for having me. Yeah, my name is Will Hegard. I work as the operations director at Footprint Project. I previously worked as a paramedic after college and then got into international humanitarian response with International Medical Corps, a large international aid group. In 2015 and 2016, I was in West Africa during the Ebola outbreak. And that's when we started thinking about Footprint and how to improve operational sustainability in humanitarian response and recovery contexts.
Wow, Ebola outbreak, that must have been incredible.
I was very lucky to be able to participate in that response. I was young.
Who was that with?
It was with a international organization called International Medical Corps. I kind of think about them like they work a lot under the office or Bureau of Humanitarian Affairs under USAID, and they're in so many countries right now. They do mobile medical, rapid. They have one of the only operating surgical suites right now in Gaza. Wow. Like they got the tents up. They're performing surgeries. Mm-hmm. Like they do some badass stuff. When the Ebola outbreak started to crescendo or spin up, MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, was there really early, like 6 months. They're the SEAL Team 6 of humanitarian aid. And IMC, International Medical Corps, was there, kind of 6 months after, because MSF was like, this is, bodies are in the street. We need international help. Like, we can't do this one alone. And yeah, I was part of not the initial response team, but I worked as an ambulance coordinator in Liberia for a little bit in 2015, and then returned as a program manager in 2016 in Guinea to run a laboratory specimen referral program. So it was basically IMC had gotten a grant from the CDC to basically support 5 health clinics in rural Guinea, train them how to safely draw blood in the Ebola recovery context. So this wasn't full suits anymore. It was more like, mask, goggles, gloves, obviously, and safely draw blood, store it in a cooler, and then put in a refrigerator or cooler in these rural clinics, put that cooler on a motorcycle, send it to Conakry in the lab where they'd take the specimen, test it for Ebola, meningitis, VHF, a couple other just crazy. There were like 5 diseases they wanted to surveil to try to monitor, like, is this thing actually done or is it, still just creeping around in the, jungles out there? And then we'd text the response, the results back to the lab or to the remote clinic so they could let that patient know. And the part of that entire program was, the challenge was how to keep the fridges running in 5 remote region, you know, five really, really remote, poor places in remote Guinea. And the grant had budgeted, because, you know, the folks in DC had been typing away the grant, like, we need 350 grand to do this project for a year. And they'd put in five generators, fuel for 12 months, you know, five new fridges, you know, just all the equipment that they would need to do it. And I came in, you know, they'd gotten the money already, and they'd hired me to kind of, like, this is often how humanitarian aid works. They, like, get the money, and they're like, now we hire someone quick, and then we run as fast as we can. And I showed up, and I was like, wow, this is hard in general, and by far the, you know, most responsibility I'd ever had in a disaster program, much less a job. You know, I was like 25, 26 or something. And I was like, shit, you know, delivering fuel or reimbursing. The original plan was we were going to reimburse the local lab for the fuel that they would buy to fill the generator that we would buy them to power the fridge that we would buy them, and then hope that fridge would stay running long enough to keep the blood samples cold enough to put them in the motorcycle to get them to the lab. You know what I mean? Like, it was in a country where corruption and poverty are just, you know, just brutal. So I had heard about solar refrigeration, and I asked the logistics guy, you know, our logistics team in Conakry, like, are these solar fridge things, like, even available? Could they work? Like, what are they 4 months out? Are they, like, what's the deal? The guy came back the next day, three quotes, installable in 3 weeks. Like, they were in Conakry. It was just like a no-brainer. Like, why would we have ever applied for the grant in the first place? Like, why wasn't this even just requested, right? Because many ways back then, it was still very new, and it was just, we went that way. We got permission of the CDC to change the budget, because it was like a little more, it's like $5,000 a pop for the solar fridges versus $2,000 for the fridge and the generator, but then $1,000 or a couple hundred bucks a month for gas for the year. So it was just like, we asked them to divert the fund, you know, do the bureaucracy stuff to get it moving. And we installed them, and I burned out of that, you know, program 7 months in, and came back home to Minnesota and was like, why the hell aren't we doing this everywhere? Like, just why didn't we ask about it? Why didn't we know about it? Why were we choosing, like, why were we making it harder ourselves when this tech exists? And this was like lead acid batteries and a single solar panel and a DC fridge, right? You know, this is not complicated mobile mic, you know, this is not fancy stuff. It was, and I think for me, it was like, shit, what we needed, or the reason it wasn't happening, is because people didn't know about it. And there wasn't, particularly in the domestic context, there's not the money to fund this type of infrastructure and provide it to responders at no or low cost, so they can learn that it works. Because if they know that it works better, and then their traditional diesel fossil fuel supply chain, they're going to pay, they'll choose it. But until they see it in the field, response and disasters is like any, you know, emergency industry, it's very tradition-based, and people use what they know. And so that's kind of where we were like, we need, where Footprint Project started. And we had been working on, you know, we applied to a hackathon right out of, you know, right after that experience in Guinea, and I was at a conference and pitched the idea of trying to build a carbon calculator for humanitarian aid. And we won the hackathon, which pushed us down this path. And here we are, six years later.
Yeah.
It's very surreal.
That's quite a background in terms of how you got into this. So, you know, I was certainly very excited to learn about how Footprint Project is expanding awareness and technical fluency around more resilient and renewable power sets for at-risk coastal communities. Could you explain a little bit how then you ended up with the Footprint Project in Louisiana? How did that come about?
Yeah, we had been basically putting batteries on trailer. Like, we bought random batteries, just whatever was on Amazon. I remember the first solar trailer we built was in Minnesota. It was like an old horse, you know, just a used wood frame trailer on Craigslist. and we put a lead acid battery and a solar, you know, a Renogy solar kit on the roof, took it to Standing Rock in that deep, you know, winter. You remember that deep freeze when the veterans mobilized for Standing Rock?
Yep.
And we were close there, so we drove it out there, and we quickly learned that a golf cart battery does not power a space heater for more than 30 minutes. But that was, we kind of started tinkering with mobile solar generators as a starter point for responders to think about operational sustainability and try to, it was just an easy first in technology for firefighters or first responders to use that would make their mission easier. Because that's the goal, right? If the equipment isn't useful for responders, or if it doesn't make their job easier, they're not going to adopt it. So we started putting solar kits on mobile frames of any kind. And during regional or after regional storms, we would just offer them for free to anyone, to any site that was going to be running a gas generator and might want to try this stuff. And for a while, it was a lot of our early responses. It was like one solar trailer in outside of one community, you know, center, you know, a library or something.
In that part of the country?
In the Midwest, just, you know, with phone charging cables hanging out of it. We were doing that until Hurricane Ida, and we were working in Tennessee at the Bonnaroo Music and Arts Festival, doing solar charging stations there when that whole festival got canceled because of Ida. And it got flooded out, and we had three solar trailers there and a couple, you know, a bunch of portable systems that we had been renting to the festival. And we I had been talking to some local groups here ahead of Ida, being like, all right, sounds like it's going to be a big disaster, or there's going to be extended power outages. Let's check in right afterwards, and if y'all are out of power, like, we'll just come down, because now the festival is canceled and we don't really have, you know, we have a bunch of equipment and it's only like 10 hours away. And we had never been to New Orleans before. We had never, you know, just was completely new to us. But yeah, they were like, we talked to them, I remember, the next day, and they were like, yeah, we need, power's out. It's going to be out for a week at least. Way down south is way worse. Get here as fast as you can. And that for us is an invite. So we don't respond unless we're invited by someone from the community, whether that's an individual or a group or an institution, whatever. But we don't just go, you know what I mean? So that was our invite. And I remember Jamie, Nate, and I were each driving truck. We had three trucks, three trailers, and a bunch of portable stuff. And we got in, like, I don't know, the week after. It took us a little bit to get all the equipment out of Bonnaroo, out of the mud, because it had been, like, you know, flooded out. And New Orleans got power back earlier, so a lot of our work was down in the bayou for, like, that's when we, you know, had a bunch of additional equipment donated or kind of thrown at us from microgrid companies. It's kind of the first response that we had had some news, any type of news coverage that was meaningful. And
who invited you
to respond here?
Yeah,
it was Miriam and the group from Imagine Waterworks. And then as we started to announce, like, hey, we have equipment, it's all free, like, just let us know. We're looking for sites, because that's the trick, is how to find appropriate sites for appropriate size solar generators or any type of sustainable infrastructure. Is it going to be used right? Is the power requirements of the site the right match for the size of the mobile microgrid that we have available at no cost, right? That's like the matchmaking game. We don't want to bring a portable generator to a fire station that needs a containerized, you know, a big microgrid, because it's not, you know, it's not going to solve their problem and it's going to waste our time. So as we were offering out, you know, hey, this is the equipment we have. I remember we got connected to just a bunch of groups in New Orleans that were like, hey, this house is doing a mutual aid hub. This is the VFW right in Uptown. That was the first place we'd stopped. They were like, we don't have power. We're doing a bunch of food distro. We set up a first initial portable generator there because they were running 2 5-kilowatt gas generators continuously. It was a bunch of fuel. It was loud. It was super hard to work around there. They were like, you could sleep in our basement if we needed to, but there was someone else who had offered a house. Like, it was just kind of just blossom. You know what I mean? Just kind of.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing how the community comes together.
Yeah, and these disaster response missions, particularly when you are lucky, when you do the prep work and have the local community buy in and you're following their lead and doing, you know, we don't do anything. We just provide back of house infrastructure services, right? For groups that are doing the direct service work, whether that's giving out the food, running the mobile medical clinic, running, you know, the community aid hub, processing the FEMA paperwork, like that, all those people that are actually serving the affected population, we are not front of house. We are back of house. What do we need? What do the people on serving the affected population need to do their jobs better? And it's usually power, water, shelter, you know, comms. And if we can get that equipment in, power being the kind of cornerstone, we can really change how they operate. And that has a ripple effect for the entire community.
Obviously, you're leading with the power, and the refrigeration is a key part of that. So do you get into water purification and other things, or how does that expand?
Yeah, well, we've started to. And I mean, we're young. We're 6 years old. We're barely, I try to remind myself that we're barely out of, if we are out of the nonprofit startup Valley of Death, we're barely out of it. Like, right. We're still very hand to mouth. We want to explore how to integrate all these things. And I think there's a huge potential for how mobile, cleaner energy systems can basically connect or power or arrive in caches or, you know, units that include water purification or atmospheric water generation, you know, refrigeration or highly efficient cooling, sustainable shelters, you know, structures, whether that's old shipping containers or like repurposed. We're using some billboards from that are coming down off of, you know, the giant plastic billboards as tarps for some of our equipment. And so we're getting into that, but for up until pretty much last year, we were doing almost exclusively cleaner energy solutions. So mobile solar microgrids to offset the 2 to 10 kilowatt gas generator, which is most of what powers the end, like the last mile point of services at many of the community aid hubs that get popped up after disasters. That's not going to support the hospital, right? But the field clinic outside the hospital, the church, the small church in Dulac, you know, like those end of line places right in the affected area are usually running cell phones and laptops and a mini fridge or a couple fridges, maybe a fan off of a portable gas generator. And if we can offer them a cleaner option that saves them fuel, prevents their few people that are just already exhausted from having to drive 3 hours to Mississippi to get gas and staying in line for another 3 hours and then pay $300 of the little money that they've raised on their GoFundMe to get back, you know, that, yeah. If you can take that out of the equation, it completely adds a whole nother, like, it's a force multiplier for the groups doing the real work. So
it's kind of our goal. And that last mile there, it's really something that people don't think about. They don't hear about. It's not really a big news story, anything like that. So you said you've been at this for about 6 years. So what have been some of the most noteworthy experiences or memorable moments that you've had that have really shaped where the Footprint Project is going now?
Yeah. Oh man, that's a great question. I mean, I think we learn with every response and every, you know, training event that we do, because we, you know, when the lights are out, we mobilize everything that we can find. And then when the lights are back on, we train as fast, you know, train as many people as we can to try to figure out, you know, how to operate a solar generator, how to build one if they, you know, on a budget, that type of stuff. I think some of our two most memorable responses have definitely been Hurricane Ida and then most recently the Maui wildfires. And those two have really, I think, shaped how we think about responding to future disasters. Because in Ida, we were much smaller, and we're still really small, but we had three people and we were all doing the logistics. So driving down, setting up, moving the equipment around, we had some folks fly in and help, which was awesome, but it was very just us, you know, out in boots in southern Louisiana for days, setting up batteries and solar panels and then taking them down as soon as the site got power. It was just very hands-on. It was brutal. It was a lot of really hard work and really hot climate. In Maui, we didn't have any equipment there, and we had gotten a bunch of requests starting to trickle in through social media, and we asked the local microgrid industry, hey, do you guys like have batteries in your, like, do you have whatever, what do you got in your warehouse? And they, because of a couple key donations, I remember Sunrun, like the 2 days after the wildfire, we were talking about what we needed. And we were like, everything that we could ship from the continental US is going to take 2 to 3 weeks. There's no turnkey microgrids available. I've asked every single supplier I know. They're all in like Chicago or the Bay or LA or New York. It's just none of it's going to get there fast enough to make any real dent. And the Sunrun was like, what if we donate 10 Tesla Powerwalls? They're in stock at Rising Sun's warehouse, and they can put them together on a pallet and build a mobile Tesla Powerwall unit. And then they can do that in 2 days. We signed the agreement to pay them to do it. And we were sitting in New Orleans, like on phone calls till 10 p.m. because Hawaii time is, you know, different, just working the site list and paying, you know, funding the local installers to do that work. And that was a huge shift for us in how we think about expanding this, because if we don't have to be in the truck and we can train microgrid companies to do disaster work, that in certain areas where there's a robust microgrid industry, that is much more efficient and much more effective than us trying to get on a plane and go to Maui, you know what I mean, and try to set up a microgrid. That, so between Ida and Maui, we learned a ton. And I would also just call out that, you know, particularly for Ida, we were really lucky to have, you know, volunteer support from Solar Alternatives, local solar company here, and Posigen. But those companies were also struggling with the outage, right? So they couldn't do all the work forever. So I think we're trying to figure out, how do we funnel enough money to support the local sustainable technology companies, whether that's microgrids, whether that's water, whether that's shelter. Our mission is to operationalize sustainability for humanitarian response. And that means putting less people on planes, putting more money into the hands of the local groups, and developing really, really quick trust with community groups, and then matchmaking vendors that have tech with site partners that need tech and funding it. Like, that's really quickly, and getting the equipment out the door. Like, that's our future, because if we're in the truck, we're taking, that means we're not paying someone locally who's closer to that community, who's closer to the affected area, who's going to be there long after we're not there to do the work. And I think for us, that's like a huge shift in how we think. And I think a lot of humanitarian response agencies, whether they're nonprofits, government, whatever, we have a lot of learning to do in how to localize the response and focus, like, how to be more trusting of the groups that are already there and will be there to do the work, because they're not, you know, we can fly in and fly out and get the photos and, you know, drum up the support and share the stories. But those people, the people in Maui now, the people, you know, in Dulac, Louisiana now, they're still there and they're not, you know, they're still either rebuilding or preparing for the next hurricane. And we just need to get them the tools they need to do their job.
On that, you're anticipating my next question here, which was, how are you building your capacity and team to respond to the growing need for Footprint Projects work with your team and that multiplier aspect? How's that going? How are you handling that?
Well, I'm getting a lot more honest with asking for money. like that's part of it is we need philanthropic and all forms of capital to make this work. We've started, you know, we're getting more blatant with just how much money it takes to put a mobile microgrid or any sustainable tech, whether that's an atmospheric water generator to replace the piles of plastic water bottles that show up in communities that don't have recycling after storms, or tarps, or any of the other fossil fuel-based infrastructure that we use to respond time and time and time again to climate disasters now, we're trying to be more honest about how big this problem is and how big an opportunity it is to like surgically tweak a response, right? If you can get the equipment in early because of really thoughtful either philanthropists or investors or whoever, but if that equipment is on standby and you can get it to the right spots, it completely changes the conversation for recovery and rebuild, right? Like you look at Maui and they're talking about rebuilding Lahaina as a complete solar, you know, you microgrid, like all the houses, everything, right? Like, and our equipment is still being used for 10 different sites for the rebuild. And those sites aren't going to get power. They might not ever get utility power back. Right. So I don't know. I think we're trying to tell better our stories more clearly and trying to capture better data on like what it means to offset X, you know, a 2 to 5 kilowatt generator for 6 months in a recovery context, because we know what it would do for the fuel that's burned, but we don't know how much fuel they would burn to get the fuel, or how much time that it would take to get the fuel, like all those knock-on costs. What's the air pollution reduction of it? What's the decibel, you know, just a site that doesn't have generators running, that's, you know, if you have a line of 100 people waiting to get aid and they've been through the worst thing in their lives, what does it do to your psychosocial care if you're running a 40 kilowatt diesel generator 20 feet or 30 feet from them and you're trying to give them, you know, counseling, right? Like, so we're trying to get better at like, all right, there's a whole picture of this here and it takes resources to do, but the investment has in our minds has a layered ROI, return on investment, that goes from impact to potentially semi-profitable if you can think long-term enough. And if you can look past the initial, you know, go, 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 response, response, response. Like, we're playing whack-a-mole with disasters these days and we're not using the right tools. Like we're still using a hammer from internal combustion engine is still the only tool in most responders' toolkits. And that's insane in 2024. Like it just particularly in the run-up to hurricane season, it makes no sense. And the tech is out there. It's just, we don't have the capital to get it out the door and put it where, and patiently wait for where community groups are going to need it. And So we're building our team. We were 3 people 2 years ago. Now we're 7. A lot of the work that we do is just connecting the dots between the community group that needs something and the vendor or supplier that has it, and clicking buy, right? Or rent or whatever to get the equipment out the door. And that takes money. And so I'm getting better. If there's any people with deep pockets listening, like, it just takes capital. And the model is not that complicated. Buy cool stuff.
How do they find you?
Footprintproject.org.
And just to remind our listeners, as always, there will be a webpage associated with Will's interview here, and that'll have lots of information about Footprint Project, what they're up to, how you can get involved, how you can volunteer, how you can donate, and all that. In that respect, do you have any favorites or key benchmarks or statistics that crystallize the Gulf Coast climate crisis for you, perhaps related to the inevitable impacts that we'll be seeing on coastal communities around the world?
Unfortunately, yeah. I mean, the two that come to mind are that, one, more people died after Hurricane Laura from carbon monoxide poisoning from running their gas generators in their garage than from the hurricane surge itself, which is just tragic and completely avoidable. And I know there's been some incredible work done locally here in New Orleans by Together New Orleans to document the number of people that died after Hurricane Ida due to just in access to electricity. And I don't know the exact number, but it's too many. I mean, it just makes no sense that we're in many of these disasters. The reason the ERs, the emergency rooms, are overflowing is not because that person had a heart attack or because they were, drowned in the house because the flooding rose and they couldn't get out. It's because the power went out, they were on an oxygen concentrator, or they were a diabetic and their refrigerator, got warm and they wanted to stay at home and they didn't have power and it got too late. And the ambulance eventually gets called and they don't make it, right? And that's just so avoidable. It's like so obviously avoidable. Like, we can solve, it's such a solvable problem. We just need the right tools and the right people, and the right relationships. And that it's not that hard to keep people out of the emergency room for energy issues and get them a portable battery, right? Like, it's this not that hard. And it should infuriate more people because it's in this day and age, energy is a human right. And the people that are the most vulnerable get hit the hardest every single time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what are some key clean energy technologies or project types that you're watching come online that could be important new tools for coastal community resilience and disaster response? Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of off-the-shelf stuff. So one, like, I love it, like, the long arc of innovation, like, more power to the DOE, Department of Energy, or any other, long moonshot technologies that are going to take years to commercialize, develop and test and commercialize. I can't wait for, like, a silicone battery to be able to, like, when I can buy one of those on Amazon, just the stuff that's, like, that I've heard about that might be or will be safer, cheaper, lighter, easier to use, longer lasting. Like, the pace of innovation is just really exciting to watch. That doesn't change the fact that if hurricanes hit, or when a hurricane or when a disaster hits this year, what are my tools that I have that aren't fossil fuel generators? It's lithium ion microgrids mostly. Maybe some lead acid if you have a heavy enough truck to, heavy enough trailer frame or a shipper that can take that type of weight. Solar or small scale wind, but I've never really seen a wind turbine yet, like, get high enough, quick enough. I know there's some really cool pilots, but it's just, I know 3 shops around New Orleans right now that have pallets of solar panels, right, ready to go. And then the new or more efficient appliances, right? Like the new walk-in coolers or the better, more efficient air conditioners, or, you know, all the innovations in efficiency that allow a solar microgrid or a hybrid microgrid, like a solar plus a generator, to work really well for responders. And I think that those integrations are really exciting. There's a lot of cool, like, I think because of the heat challenges, there's a lot of really exciting innovations in cooling that are required, particularly in, I think it's interesting because there's the point, there's a connection point where, like, if you look at drawdown or drawdown space, the research they've done is that's like all the HCFs or
the drawdown project.
Yeah, yeah. And they say that the cooler, you know, the hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs or CFCs, or I'm butchering it, but those are one of the most impactful things that influence the global warming or the changing climate. And so, like, innovations in refrigeration technology that work well with solar microgrids are going to be hugely, you know, helpful for populations that are affected by rising heat and heat extremes, right? Across the Southeast, Arizona, Southwest, you know, it's just like an obvious, hey, if we can get good coolers that don't require a generator and can run off of a battery, that can save lives, right? Firefighters can deploy them out as cooling centers. It's a no-brainer. So, like, those types of integrations, I think I'm really excited about from a tech side. And then I think the more important work that we often forget is that the tech doesn't all really matter if you don't have the right people using it. Like, the number of times I've been to disasters where they have, you know, shipping containers of either RVs or shelters or bottled water or food, and they've just dropped it in a place and no one's there. No one's using it. They're running gas. I remember this after Hurricane Ian in Florida or Idalia last year. There's just huge camps of, looks like a festival if no one came up to the festival, because everybody wants to stay in their house and build, you know, go back to their life, right? So I think the innovations or the work that needs to be done to match tech to the community, the people that are going to actually use it, so we're not shipping 40 truckloads of supplies from Kentucky to outside of Tampa to build an aid camp that no one uses. Like, that shouldn't happen, right? And, like, that takes not just new tech, but it takes new models of delivery and understanding who should get to decide or who should be at the table when we're figuring out how to get aid in. And it really comes from listening to the people that are on the ground. Like, just get them to the table. Like, don't make those decisions on your own. And it's not, that's like so simple. It's just not that hard. But oftentimes there's such a white horse mentality in aid where it's like, we have this thing, we fundraised for it, we're going to get in our truck and go down and, like, do the thing, take a bunch of photos and put them on Instagram and then leave. And that's just, I think I'm really excited to see more critical thinking in how, why, and who is responding, and why it might not be the best idea to send 30 old white men from Minnesota to go down to southern Louisiana during Ida, and maybe they should just spend that travel money on paying the people down there what they need to recover. You know what I mean? Like, that work is as important, if not more important, than matchmaking the right air conditioner with the right battery microgrid. Like, that's cool and it's fun to talk about, but the real challenge is convincing the disaster response industry to stop doing dumb things and start doing response the way it needs to reflect what we need in the 21st century. Like, we just need to completely, like, we got to rethink this whole thing. You know what I mean?
Like a couple of our other guests, it was fun to learn that we have a Burning Man connection in common. And I certainly see some parallels between the work that the Footprint Project is doing in Burners Without Borders. Is there any connection there? Or certainly your origin story in terms of IDA is very similar, but is there any ongoing connection with the work that they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely cheering each other on. We've yet to find like a really strong alignment in terms of like, hey, this is what we can do together, where we can both be like, we responded, you know, we did this one thing outside of the actual event. We've learned a lot from participating in that event earlier in Footprint's development. I'll just tell one quick story about in 2018, this is right after I came back from West Africa. We were tinkering, built that green, you know, this wood horse trailer with a solar kit. The first place outside of Standing Rock that we took it was Burning Man. We tested that, living out of that thing. And I was still working at Rampart, the mobile, you know, the medical field hospital that they set up in Nevada for the Burning Man event. And another fun fact, that field hospital becomes the third busiest ER in the country for the week of the event. The same shipping container, you know, field hospital. It's like a massive 52-foot, 53-foot RV with bump outs that bump out on either side to create this like, you know, 40-foot by 40-foot clinic, right? Where they intubate people and prep them before they get on the the helicopter to Vegas or Reno. That piece of infrastructure, that mobile clinic, is also a standby asset for FEMA. So they do the CrowdRx does the Burning Man event, and then it's also available for regional, you know, large scale disaster response. So I love that idea because these events have so much to offer the response community in learning and testing and simulating energy infrastructure or sustainable infrastructure in general, along with the operation, like how to set it up, how you would deploy it, how people would use it. Like there's such a synergy between putting 70,000 or 80,000 people in a remote context for 2 weeks and figuring out how to live without the grid and without the traditional infrastructure that we have and we rely on day to day. So in 2017 and 2018, we were lucky to be able to pilot pretty small stuff, but brought out a pallet of solar panels and a portable, you know, a 10 to 15 kilowatt hour lithium battery box and plugged in the lights and some of the ESD, the Emergency Service Department equipment at Rampart. And they let us, you know, pilot it. And it was like, for me, that was way before we had done IDA or Maui or any of this, right? We were just, this is when I was like still learning how, like what red and black meant on a battery, you know what I mean? And the kind of, I think the ability or the flexibility that org has to allow people to iterate in the city they create, they've built a really special engine for innovation. I think Burners Without Borders is a great vehicle to start the conversation.
What about World Kitchen? Have you had any contact with them?
World Central Kitchen, yeah. They helped. They bought two shipping containers for us after a year after Hurricane Maria, that we used to store a donation of 53 pallets of solar panels from Sunnova. And we used them because we didn't have any other storage space. And we used them for storage. Then we distributed those panels to a bunch of the farmers in their plow to plate program in Puerto Rico. They're an incredible org, particularly with a lot of the larger, well-funded, well-renowned, very well-known, forward-thinking institutional aid, you know, response groups. We're really trying to figure out, all right, when are we subsidizing you and when are you subsidizing us? When should the groups be paying for something and when should they be getting it for free, and who should be paying and who should be getting it for free? And we take that really seriously, and we just don't have the finance. We don't have the deep enough pocket donors to be like, yeah, spend $5 million on mobile microgrids and atmospheric water generators and put them in a field and wait. It's totally doable. It's really not even that much money for the broader aid space. That's why I think Footprint is an interesting thing to work on, because it takes a group to take the risk. We're the group that sits in the middle and says, let's buy some really expensive stuff, make it work, and then share the lessons. Whether they're the, hey, this site drained the battery 4 times and ended up using a generator, or hey, we sized it, we got it right this time, and look at all the knock-on good things that happened because this group was able to turn off their generator for 6 months and serve hundreds of people with community coolers that are quiet, safer, and no cost.
Great. Well, is there anything else that we haven't had a chance to touch on that you want to make sure you share with our audience or tell us about?
Well, one, just thank you for having me and listening, you know, sharing the story. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, it's an important story. So I'm really glad we're getting a chance to get it out there and hopefully get more exposure. And again, we'll have information on how people can get in touch with you and support your work.
Thanks. Yeah, and I just leave with, I hope this has come across, but getting sustainable infrastructure technologies out helps in all these quantitative ways. But I think there's a bit of the story, or a lot of the story, that needs to be still be told about, like, the qualitative benefits of moving sustainable infrastructure, whether that's solar panels and batteries or water generators or recycling things, whatever was going to be the newest, coolest thing that we can fund, borrow, beg, whatever, what it does for a community that has just been ravaged by a climate disaster. Because for me, I've yet to find a more powerful, like, vision of hope, like being able to roll in the future of what a community can look like in the first 12 to 24 hours after a storm, when the houses are destroyed, when everybody's like still cleaning up the rubble in the street, and they're still in tears, and they're still, they've got 3 to 5 years now of recovery. Being able to provide it seems so silly, but like a charging station that is a solar thingy in the middle of that just devastation, and offer free Wi-Fi and a place to plug your phone in, maybe a place to fill up your water bottle. What that does for a community to see, like, we might be able to build back even better. This is a vision of the future in a place that is just devastated by the current climate emergency that just barreled through them. That qualitative thing, that I just can't stress, that there's no number. Like, there's just, you know, we have no clue what that does for the policies, the city council meetings, the number of times we hear, like, oh, that thing, I remember that thing. That was the solar thing that was at the community center. We have no clue what the ripple effects are. And I guess to end on like a blue note, like, those ripple effects, I think, are really powerful.
Fantastic. Well, what's next for you, Will? What are you most excited about in your personal or professional life?
I'm not going anywhere. We got a long way to go. I'm trying to build this thing as fast as I possibly can, and I don't really think about anything else.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. It's been an honor to speak with you and to learn about your work, and we'll really look forward to staying in touch and hopefully being able to support what you're up to.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us on the Blue Economy Primer. If you enjoyed today's podcast, don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Please help us spread the word and be sure to visit our website at www.deepblue.academy, where you can find all of our available episodes, access important links and supporting information for each episode, send us your comments and or suggestions for potential guests and topics, get more information about our community engagement initiatives, and join our mailing list, as well as make a much-appreciated tax-deductible donation to support our nonprofit education and research mission. Thanks again to the Dan Lucas Memorial Foundation and the Pontchartrain Conservancy for their critical financial and institutional support. Until next time, when we meet again on the ever-expanding horizon of the blue economy.